This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm your host, Jackson Reinhardt, and today I am with Chantel Gray to talk about her new book, Anarchism, After Deleuze and Guattari, Fabulating Futures, published by Bloomsbury Press, 2022. Deleuze and Guattari never identified as anarchists, nor do they seem to know much about its historical development or continued practice. Yet their individual and collective work belies this apparent and willful oversight through a steady consideration of revolutionary subjectivity and active political experimentation. Chantel Gray argues that while we cannot and should not attempt to call them anarchists, their work resonates with core anarchist principles such as prefiguration, careful experimentation, and emergent strategies aimed at creating a feeling that life is worth living. This involves paying attention to both joyous effects and sad passions, which necessitates the affirmation of all of chance, and from that, fabulating new modes of existence. By bringing together the philosophy of Deleuze and Guattari with theory and practices of anarchism, the book demonstrates that fabulating the future is nothing short of a noetic art, making reasonable something which initially was senseless. And Chantel Gray is associate professor in the School of Philosophy at Northwest Point University, South Africa. Chantel, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Well, fantastic. I thought this book was wonderful. So give us a sense of not only your academic background, but the impetus that led to the writing of Anarchism After Deleuze and Guattari.
I have quite a checkered background. I started off, in cognitive linguistics and more analytic philosophy, really. And actually through literature, discovered the work of Deleuze and Guattari and also became interested in anarchism. I met some anarchists. I was, close politically at that point in my thinking, but you know, like many other people, I didn't have a really good understanding of what anarchism was. Sort of some ideas, you know, I'd read maybe a little bit of Emma Goldman, but it was rough, you know, there was no clear idea. And so at the beginning of doing my PhD, which was quite later in my academic career, I really gave myself over to Deleuze and Guattari and just kind of went for it. And at that point, I had already turned more to continental philosophy and had done quite a bit of work in French philosophy. But I really started exploring their work. And at the same time, I was reading a lot of anarchist texts and really becoming more familiar with anarchist theory and practice, and also started calling myself an anarchist. So I guess it sort of became a kind of a melting pot in my head. And I started seeing these overlaps between their thinking, even though, of course, we know Deleuze and Guattari called themselves Marxist right until the end. And as you just read, they didn't really engage in any substantial way with anarchist thought, except maybe through their you know, the work of Pierre Clastres, and you know, they were also friends with him. So there was that kind of, meeting between anarchism and Deleuze and Guattari. And so And so when I thought about writing this book, I wanted to bring these ideas together in a kind of substantive way. And of course, many other theorists have done this. Thomas Nail, Saul Newman, you know, all the post-anarchists. But none of those works are quite introductory and also extensive enough for me. They focus on very specific ideas in these different trajectories. And so I wanted to bring these ideas together in a kind of overview of what anarchism is and what Deleuze and Guattari is.
No, I thought this was a very helpful introduction, not only to contemporary anarchist theory and praxis, but importantly, an introduction to two very difficult 20th century thinkers, Deleuze and Guattari. Tell us a little bit about who they were and the kind of shape of their philosophy. What was their philosophical ouvert?
So, of course, they wrote about many things. Deleuze started off writing actually books about other philosophers. You know, we have the book on Hume, Nietzsche, and so on. And so he was really schooled in philosophy. He's a very rigorous thinker. But he also, what makes Deleuze unique is that he takes kind of other people's work and puts a kind of spin on them, right? And reads them almost through his own project. And what is his project? This is a very broad question, but I think we can sum it up in a kind of a way. And I think it's really contained for me in Difference and Repetition, at least his philosophical work before Guattari. And that is that he's really trying to think not only about ontology, but about what gives rise to life. What are the conditions needed for life to unfold, for thought to unfold, and for something new to emerge from what is already there? And of course, you know, we know that he was very influenced by Simon Dom. And so we can think of his work really as thinking about ontogenesis rather than ontology. So Guattari, on the other hand, was a psychoanalyst. He actually studied under Lacan. But of course, Lacan didn't like Anti-Oedipus, which he wrote with Deleuze. And he moved away from that kind of thinking quite substantially in his life. And it was really in their meeting. Of course, you know, Guattari was also involved in many forms of politics. And something happened when he and Deleuze met that I think is unique in the history of philosophy. And I guess what it brought to Deleuze's philosophy and also to Guattari's practice is something very unique. They started thinking about these very difficult philosophical concepts that Deleuze had developed in his work and how to apply it not only in, say, thinking about thought, which is, of course, something that is a very philosophical question, but, you know, how do we think about it in terms of politics, in terms of socio-political organization, in terms of, you know, even kind of animals, if you want to think, and stratifications in you know, kind of social strata. So women, animals, in terms of race classification. And so it became this very broad project, which initially, of course, it finds its culmination in what is philosophy. But I guess the most read book, I would say, is probably A Thousand Plateaus, because it's so beautifully written. It's this kind of amalgamation of poetry and psychoanalysis and philosophy and just all of these different things mixed together. But of course, their first book was Anti-Oedipus, and that is a book in which they bring together the theory of Marx and psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis. And so And I guess that's more a formal book. It's quite a difficult book because it deals with sort of their rethinking of capitalism and desire. They have two very big oeuvres together and separately, covering many, many subjects. But I guess if you want to sum it up, what they really both, for me at least, are trying to think about is how to live in ways that allow us more freedom, both individually and communally.
And that pertains particularly to a project of anarchism, a sense of kind of a greater freedom that now exists. And so as we go into the book, we go from the broad, the what they were doing, to the narrow of how they relate to anarchism, you begin the book discussing this concept of statist realism. Tell us a little bit about this concept and how it relates to the way in which we collectively and individually conceptualize politics.
So statist realism is really a term that I kind of invent by riffing on Mark Fisher's term of capitalist realism. And of course, what he's trying to talk about is how capitalism has changed the very way we think in the world. And so using that, I start thinking about why it is that, you know, when you speak to people, when I speak to people often, people who aren't anarchists, there's always this question like, okay, but how will we organize without the state? Who will clean the trash? What happens when societies become too large? You need a state. And so this, I think, is a question that fascinates me, but it definitely fascinated Deleuze and Guattari also. They developed this idea of the state apparatus. And so I started thinking about what it is exactly that keeps us from thinking about what social organization could look like outside of state societies, especially given that we've only lived in state societies for a relatively short period of time, in our evolution. So it's kind of a conundrum. And so the more I started thinking about it, the more this idea of statist realism kind of fermented in my brain, where I was starting to think about, okay, it's something to do with the limits of our thought. There's something that has changed the way we think to such a degree that we can't get outside of that framework. And so, you know, Deleuze refers to this as the dogmatic image of thought. You know, he explains in the third chapter of Difference and Repetition, and of course he's thinking about philosophy and what keeps us from breaking out of philosophical kind of frameworks. But he says, well, what happens is that, you know, we have these traditions, and these traditions get passed on, and they get developed, but the frameworks themselves never get questioned. So the content of the framework changes, but the framework itself stays in place. And so thinking about politics, you know, and as I was writing this, Biden had just been chosen. And, that meme of Bernie Sanders went viral. And I was so struck by that because it was so funny, you know, that Biden's inaugural kind of, became backgrounded by this viral image of Senator Sanders. And, you know, it was cute. It was kind of cute because he was sitting there with mittens and so on, and it, you know, and a mask because it was still the pandemic. But what struck me really about it was that it seemed like a placeholder for what people wanted. This ideal, like, oh no, the wrong person. You know, we're glad that Trump is out of office, but the wrong person is now in office. And we should have somehow had Bernie Sanders there. But that is a limit in imagination. because instead of thinking, hold on, there's something wrong with the way in which the framework of politics is done. So we change the content. We go from Trump to Biden to Bernie Sanders. And all of that is great because at least there's change, right? It's not totalitarian. And so that's not to be dismissed. But it is a limit on what is actually possible. And so status realism describes that, the limits of imagination that the state itself has imposed on our thought. So thought itself conforms to the form of the state. And, this is kind of implicit, actually, in Deleuze and Guattari's idea of the state apparatus, which doesn't refer to the state, but to a kind of form of organization that is kind of hierarchizing, sets up different groups against each other and so on.
No, I've read much Mark Fisher and I appreciate his work, but after reading your book, I think I much prefer statist realism as a more encompassing concept than capitalist realism, although both are extremely useful. So you mentioned state apparatus in your prior answer, and leading on in your argument, you mentioned that states, and you also touched on this in your prior answer, that states aren't historically necessary, that states are actually very contingent in that humans have been around for tens of thousands of years, but states as we know them have only been around for a few thousand, and in many parts of the world only for a few hundred. What are the ways in which the state in its infancy and as it continued on employed its power, asserted its power, expanded its power in these notions of the apparatus of capture, as you mentioned?
Yeah, so Deleuze and Guattari develop the apparatus of capture in terms of, what was it again? Profit, it's profit, tax, and striations. So what the state does, of course, there's this theory. There are many theories in political science, and these theories have actually become so commonplace that most people assume them. One of them is that we need states because people are actually in their own selves quite brutish in nature, and we would be out to get each other all the time, and so we need the state. And so, how does the state go about capturing the world in the way we know it? So early states, of course, the first thing they have to do is they have to capture land. So once there's land, they can kind of striate and grid it. And people then get assigned to land. And why do people get assigned to land? Well, the state can then say, look, we own this land. Now you're on this land that we own, but you have to pay us tax. So you have to work for the state. And so people start working for the state. And of course, this is not done, people didn't want to do this. They were forced to do this. And this is what goes unaccounted for in many accounts of early states, is the violence by which they enforced themselves in territories. And if people don't believe it, of course, there are very good examples in recent history, which is colonialism, which was just a kind of extension of what had already taken place, a very dramatic extension. But that violence was always there. And so one of the more interesting aspects for me, actually, because I guess this, this kind of makes sense. It's like, okay, they take plots of land. They say, this land belongs to me. This is my land. We're the state, or I'm the king. This land belongs to me. I'm going to grid it. I'm going to put you all there. Then I know where you are. You have to work for me. And as a kind of what you gain from this is that I protect you against other kingdoms. But I guess the more interesting thing for me was reading James Scott and thinking about food, specifically wheat, and the reduction in the variety of food or foodstuff that was grown, because wheat is very taxable. And so, of course, it makes it easy for, you know, for the state to kind of assign a plot to a certain person, to make them grow wheat, to kind of weigh that wheat, and then to say, okay, this is the amount of tax you owe me. And so, this is really interesting, because if we think about monocrops today, it sort of became clear to me that this has a much longer history than what we typically think, right? Monocrops seem to be something that is kind of modern and, you know, has taken place, especially in the last, let's say, 50 years as become worse. And of course it has, but it has this long history right to the beginning of states. And so I guess that was actually very interesting for me, because when I think about states today and the kinds of problems we have from states today, it seems like even though states are not necessary and they have taken up a relatively short amount of space in the history of humankind, they've also implemented, social engineering practices that have quite a long history. And although they seem very sophisticated today, and they are very sophisticated today, they have these sort of links. And so when we look at things like monocrops, we can think about the invention of the cadastral map. And so mapping, which now, of course, is linked to things like GPS, and, you know, everyone knows where you are all the time. So it's hugely sophisticated. But it has, again, a very long history to social engineering practices of the state. And so when Deleuze and Guattari talk about the state apparatus as an apparatus of capture, it's really because the state captures land, it captures people, it grids them, it creates kind of binaries between them, so that they can be used in specific ways for state purposes.
So we've already discussed a little bit about, and you mentioned this, about taking over people and through both the ownership of land and then the payment of tax from working on the land, that the state derives its income. Income related to taxation, related to economy. And so in a kind of long sense, how do the ways in which Deleuze and Guattari discussing things like taxation, apparatus of capture, as well as capitalism itself, how does this relate to anarchist thought? How does this inform anarchist thought, discussing the way in which the state is related to both economic extraction and then the capitalist enterprise itself?
So this is a really good question, because this is actually what makes Deleuze and Guattari's work kind of closer for me to anarchist practices than to Marxist. And of course, you know, this is not to kind of diss all of Marxism, because, you know, anarchist and Marxist ideas came out of the same milieu. In fact, many of the ideas then put forth by Marx was actually kind of developed by Proudhon. And so, you know, they were in the same milieu. So we have to think about this as ideas, kind of libertarian ideas that emerged from a milieu in which they were all living. But of course, what makes anarchist critiques of the state and of capitalism different is that Marx still sees the need for a kind of transitional state, which, you know, he posits will wither away. But for anarchists, this is a problem of form and content. This is saying, you know, what we spoke about a bit earlier, saying, okay, hold on, we wanted to change quite a lot in what we see in the world around us, but we still think the state form is necessary. So it keeps that form. And what anarchists say is, if we keep that form, we can't separate means from ends. So if our ends are freedom and stateless societies, we have to prefigure that from the very start. Otherwise, we end up with Stalinism. So, you know, we can't separate those. And so this is where Deleuze and Guattari are very close to anarchist analyses, because they understand this about the state or the state apparatus. They understand that this form of organization will always lead to more of that form of organization. You cannot escape a statist form of organization by using a state apparatus in any kind of way, which is not to say that there's no place for any hierarchical organization, right? Like sometimes, and I don't mean like strong hierarchical organization, I mean sort of weak hierarchical organization. Like sometimes you're in a situation and somebody needs to make a decision, and maybe there's somebody who has more expertise in a certain kind of field. And so that is a kind of natural leadership position. And anarchists are not against that. They're very much for, you know, sometimes there's this understanding that maybe anarchists are against skills or kind of expertise, but that's not at all what it is. It's more that they encourage you to develop your own expertise and not necessarily expertise that serve the state in some way. Now, of course, you know, for Marx also, economics is the base of society. But for anarchists, politics and economics can't be so very easily distinguished. They go together. And this is actually what Deleuze and Guattari also make clear with their understanding of the apparatus of capture, which includes the state part and the economic part. So, and not even those two, you know, these are complex. The world is complex. We, you know, to reduce, especially these days, to reduce the world to a kind of simple base, I think is to take away the complexity of the world. And that actually denies more complex theorizations of how to overcome the problems that we have. And so again, you know, and I think this was actually, at least some of the anthropological work that Deleuze and Guattari were working with, definitely influenced their thoughts and gave them kind of some inclination of anarchist views. Again, the work of Pierre Clastres. And I think, and I'm not pronouncing that right, but my French is not good enough to to pronounce it in any proper way.
No, my French isn't good either. So no, I'm not judging on that front.
So I think that's interesting, is that they definitely had that understanding, right? There was that anarchistic understanding that we cannot just have an economic base. It's not only about these two classes in societies. It's actually that, you know, there's stuff like race, like gender, like economics, like politics, like migrancy, and all of this stuff. All of this, and many more other things, technology and whatever, makes up a very complex society. And so to understand, you know, of course they do give a special importance to capitalism. And I do think, you know, and of course anarchists also do that, because capitalism is a system that has now been in place. And what we've seen from it is that it adapts, it continually adapts. So they do give prominence to it, just as anarchists do, but they do so in a more constellative manner. So, you know, when anarchists like Deleuze and Guattari talk about things like race or economics or the state, they do so as part of a constellation of concepts. And so you have to understand their concepts always as part of what they would call maybe an assemblage of other concepts. So you can never understand something only as like this kind of discrete idea. And I think that is what makes, well, that's what also gives me kind of a resonance between Deleuze and Guattari and anarchist thought. And I think that's actually what is useful for us for thinking about anarchist practices today, is to understand even how these concepts have developed, you know, how things have changed, and to understand them in terms of new constellations of concepts. For example, and you know, I talk about this later in the book, but is algorithmic governmentality and the way in which technology has really changed both, kind of social engineering practices of the state. It's changed capitalism. It's changed the way we interact with the world. And so I think that kind of update is really important. And I think, you know, this is something I really like about anarchism and Deleuze and Guattari's work, is that it kind of lends itself to autocritique. So, you know, I think Deleuze even says this somewhere, like he would hate for people to just, to kind of follow his work slavishly. And he didn't do that with other philosophers, you know. He kind of, as he said, he took them from behind and created kind of monstrous offspring from them. And I think that's really something that is, yeah, that resonates so strongly for me between these bodies of work, is that kind of autocritique, like, okay, we've said this, but is it still valid? You know, can we still use these concepts? And I think that's really important for making any political praxis alive.
You mentioned algorithmic governmentality, which leads to the next section of your book. Your first three chapters that we discussed are a kind of symptomology of the state. And then the remaining three chapters are that becoming anew, becoming future, that portentive look, to employ a kind of neologism. So discuss the way in which, and you mentioned this briefly, the way in which, and this is so essential for kind of prefiguring an anarchist horizon, the way in which algorithmic systems change, condition the way in which we relate to the world, humans, the way in which algorithms are conditioning us in ways, you know, more vast and more internalized and exteriorized than at any other point in history.
So this is a continuing field of interest for me, and particularly because technology, you know, a couple of years ago, even 10, 20 years ago, you know, you could keep up with technological change. It was possible. But things are changing so quickly now that it's not only almost impossible to keep up with technological change, but also to theorize it. Because if you think about this, theory usually takes quite long. You know, we kind of, to really grapple with something, you kind of have to immerse yourself in a whole lot of thought, other people's thought, the thing that you're investigating, things that led up to that. And so to kind of theorize what is happening usually takes long. But I think one of the demands that algorithmic governmentality, and just to make clear to people what algorithmic governmentality is, it is this idea that people and social problems can be treated as data sets rather than as kind of complex co-imbrications of all kinds of things that demand different kinds of answers, you know. And so it's kind of flattened the way in which we respond to real world problems. So that's on a kind of more, I guess, if you want to say a more statist kind of level, but at a more individual level and communal level, I think it's really, really changing the way not only that we interact with each other, but also the way we think. Again, you know, there's a kind of a new form of thought, I would say, is unfolding. And so one of the things that is obviously clear that it has done is that it's eroded societies. You know, people are very, we're all very online people. And so, you know, if you think about this, what does being online lend itself to? Well, if you're on Twitter, for example, it lends itself to very quick responses. It lends itself to quite polemic responses to social problems, to polarized kind of responses. And of course, algorithms, as we know, learn from our behavior. But they don't only learn from our behavior, they're actually teaching us how to behave. So, you know, maybe a silly example, but it's a good example to illustrate this, is if you think about emoticons. Now, emoticons have been with us for quite some time. But I sometimes wonder, you know, when we are experiencing something in the world, like let's say something happens at work and you're feeling kind of uncomfortable, you're not sure how, instead of thinking about what it is that you're feeling, you assign an emoticon in your head to it, you know? And so there's that kind of, again, it's a kind of simplification of what is happening, but it is also a simplification of the actual emotions we're feeling. And what is interesting to me, really, is that I've been doing a lot of research on dopamine and dopamine pathways. And of course, we know that these technologies are designed to hijack our attention and our actual dopamine pathways. And so I think something very insidious is happening, that is happening at a kind of pre-conscious level. And so I think the way we think about life, about politics, about community, about social organization, about love, about all of these things is changing at a level I don't think we're even aware of yet. And so I don't talk so much about this in the book, but I do touch on this. And I think, you know, when we think of politics, for me, it has real implications for how we do politics, because I don't think we can. So I'm not someone who's against technology or anything like that. I think it's made our lives wonderful. So I'm not. I don't want to say abolish everything and, you know, let's all throw it up in the air. But I do think for us to get back to a place where we. You know, Rancière makes this distinction between the political, which is kind of, you know, what we would think of as like status politics, you know, voting, that kind of thing. And then, so that's the political, and then doing politics. Doing politics would be like what we do on the ground, you know, to organize food for homeless, or, you know, to kind of organize a protest or something like that. And so I think more and more we're participating in the political. And it's a kind of algorithmic political. And I think for us to get back to really doing politics, we need to forge communities offline. Not that online communities haven't helped people. I think they're hugely important in many ways. You know, we see this especially in the LGBTQI movement. They've really given people support and information and so on. So again, you know, it's not as simple as saying it's bad, but I do think we need to get offline. We need to get in touch with people. We need to develop our ways of responding to the world together in kind of more nuanced ways than what the internet allows for, than what algorithmic governmentality allows for.
Yes, you end that chapter on you know, called Hacking for Our Lives, on a rather bleak note, right? You say that not only do we have this kind of, you know, ecological, epidemiological crisis that is occluding future potentialities of thought and action, but we also have this algorithmic governmentality and conditioning, which is limiting our means of conceptualizing participation in social realms. But you say in the following chapter that no, we can fabulate a life worth living, believing in this world again. And you reference the three aspects of what you call the counter-actualization. And as someone who loves Pulp Fiction, the fact that they're named after genres of genre fiction, I appreciate. So just elaborate how these counter-actualization in these three aspects leads us to forging a world to believe in again.
So I think there's this interesting tension in Deleuze and Guattari studies between affirmation and non-affirmation. So there's been the kind of theorists who want to affirm everything and so on, and there's a new kind of strand of theorists saying, let's break everything down. And so this tension is something that really interests me because we see both of it in the work of Deleuze and Guattari. And so I started thinking really about, you know, this thing that Deleuze says and that Deleuze and Guattari even say in many different parts of their work. Deleuze says, perhaps one of the most difficult things is believing in this world. And it struck me as true. It struck me as like, you know, like when I see my students or sometimes, you know, just read articles and so on, or when you read Stigler and he talks about young people who have lost the ability to dream, you know, this is something that really, really haunts his own thought also, this idea of like dreamless societies. It really made me think about what anarchism tries to do in the world. And I think what it does try and do is give us reasons to believe in the world, in this world, to kind of create the revolution in the here and now. And so I found this kind of funny little throwaway comment in Difference and Repetition. It's right in the beginning where Deleuze talks a little bit about this idea of the detective novel and the science fiction novel and the apocalyptic novel, but he never explains it. It's just this kind of throwaway comment. But I really liked it. And I started thinking, you know, I also really like, actually during COVID, and I think it was maybe my coping mechanism, but I started reading only science fiction for a while, even though I've always loved science fiction, but I sort of became obsessive. And it was just kind of interesting because it kind of, you know, I guess that's something I also love about Deleuze and Guattari is that they bring together something quite literary and something quite philosophical. I really love that about their work. And so this idea of a detective novel and a science fiction novel and an apocalyptic novel started sort of fermenting in my head. And I started thinking, funny enough, about the three syntheses of time that Deleuze talks about. And those are notoriously difficult to grapple with. But I sort of started seeing counter-actualization as, I guess, this way of countering algorithmic governmentality. And I saw it in terms of these three aspects, which you just mentioned. And so the first is the detective novel. And so there's even there's a chapter in A Thousand Plateaus about the novella. It's a very sort of, nobody really writes about that chapter. It's a kind of, you know, I think everyone reads it and goes like, what is this chapter doing here? Because it seems kind of strange, you know, it doesn't really speak to anything like the others in such a clear way. But I started thinking about that chapter and they asked that question, what happened? What happened? And so I started seeing this chapter in a little bit of a new light and thinking about it in terms of symptomatology. And of course, you know, this is something that they get from Nietzsche, who saw us as clinicians of culture. And so I started thinking, well, maybe this kind of detective aspect of counter-actualization is the symptomatology, is figuring out what happened. And, you know, as Deleuze says, posing problems at the level of practice. And so this is interesting because he says that in the Hume book already, which is his first book. And of course, this has now become something, you know, a little bit of a, it's kind of a cliche almost. You know, and if, I didn't even want to use it in the book because it's been said so much, but I do like it, where he says, problems always get the answers they deserve. So I started thinking about this, like, what does this mean, you know, in terms of anarchist praxis? Okay, well, it means we have to think about the world, we have to diagnose the world in ways that don't submit us to the dogmatic image of thought. And if we can't do that, we're posing problems at the level of the dogmatic image of thought rather than at the level of practice, as he says. And so I started thinking, well, then this must be the first aspect of counter-actualization, is really, really diagnosing problems outside our own frames of reference, which is a difficult thing to do, right? Because not very easy to get outside of your own frame of reference. So it's a challenge. It's actually a challenge. And a hugely difficult one, I would think. But then, you know, the second sort of aspect, I was thinking, okay, but if we're raising these problems, it's obviously because we want to move to something better. And what is this thing that we want to move towards? So that, I would say, is the science fiction or utopian dimension of counter-actualization. And so, you know, we can also think in terms of this as then the first and second syntheses of time. So, you know, forming of habits. And then Deleuze says, but the forming of habits is actually presupposed by something. What is that? Well, memory. So you make habits when you have memories of something, right? You can't form habits if there's no memory to make the habits from. But so this is kind of very interesting for me again, because then I started thinking, well, this is quite close to the ritornello. And of course, you know, actually, if you think about this, the three syntheses of time is really taken up in the ritornello or the refrain chapter in A Thousand Plateaus. It's just a, they just give it a different tenor. And so what do they talk about? You know, it opens with that beautiful little piece about the child singing in the dark. And, you know what? Why does a child sing in the dark? Well, because he or she or they are feeling a bit lost. They're feeling a little like maybe they're afraid of the dark. So they sing to give themselves a feeling of home, a little bit of consistency. And then they move on and they say, they talk about the person in the home. And so there's, immediately I started thinking, okay, so there's, you know, there's this relationship between kind of creating a little bit of consistency. And then what is the next thing they say? Going out into the open and experimentation. And so this is very anarchist, right? Because prefiguration is exactly that, isn't it? It's kind of experimenting with new forms of communal living or new forms of protest or whatever it is. But it's not out of nowhere. It's based on like previous practices. It's refining previous practices. And it's also, you know, if you think about politics, And you know, many sort of radical politics have been critiqued for this, that they fall apart. They fall apart because, you know, suddenly people, we can say, deterritorialized too fast. You know, they tried out too many new things too quickly. they moved into a commune, they all became polyamorous, and then suddenly they realized this is not for them, and the whole political project fell apart. So instead of just throwing everything to the wind, what Deleuze and Guattari say is, well, we do need experimentation, but we need to do so carefully. And that's how we build the body without organs, right? Is we practice careful experimentation. But experimentation requires a final aspect, and that final aspect is the apocalyptic aspect. And this is actually, of course, the more destructive part then. Because what is an apocalypse? It's a total destruction of what is. And it is making life out of this destruction. And so this, for me, is where it brings together the affirmative part of Deleuze and the non-affirmative camp, you know. It's affirming all of chance. That's what Deleuze says. And so it includes a destructive aspect as much as a building aspect. Affirmation is not only about these joyous affects. It's also sometimes about destroying the lines of domination in the world as much as in our own thought.
We have elaborated on finding experimentation with a kind of consistent base after posing these problems outside of our framework, and then finding ways of reducing domination, of ridding ourselves of domination. And in that final piece, ridding ourselves of domination, that's always synonymous with the notion of the revolution. If there's any kind of concept that anarchists are associated with, anytime I grow a beard, I have people call me a bomb. I look like a bomb-throwing anarchist, right? Performing the propaganda of the deed. But anarchists are known as revolutionary figures. And you connect the Deleuze-Guattarian concept of the nomadic war machine to the notion of revolution. What is this nomadic war machine in their thought, and how does it relate to anarchist revolution?
So I must say, Jackson, that I really try to avoid talking about revolution in the book. I was kind of really scared of going there because, you know, it is that propaganda of the deed, which, you know, even though it's such a small part of the history of anarchism, it's so deeply ingrained in people's brains. And of course, the CIA was directly, or the FBI rather, was directly, responsible for this, because they developed this kind of file on people like Emma Goldman and so on, and started talking about anarchists being these dangerous people. And she was classified as the most dangerous woman, you know, in the world at some point. And so I think that has stuck somewhere in people's minds. But the funny thing is that, you know, if you look, you know, it was the time of revolution, the kind of 1920s, early, 1900s. It was the time of revolutions, late 1800s. Lots of revolutions took place. It was a word that was in the air and so on. But what is interesting is that people also, it's not just anarchists. It's a lot of leftist people that actually resorted to propaganda by the deed. And so it just kind of became associated with anarchism, specifically because of the word anarchy, which was used derogatively in the media. And so having tried to avoid this, I realized that I really couldn't, because it's so such an integral part of anarchism. And to take the revolution out of anarchism is to give it a kind of purely pacifist kind of framework. And I think that actually takes away something about the anarchist spirit, one can say. And so, you know, this is of course also true for the nomadic war machine, which is again also a very difficult concept to grapple with in Deleuze and Guattari's thought. But for them, it's important. And there are very strong resonances between the nomadic war machine and revolution. And so the nomadic war machine for Deleuze and Guattari is that which resists the state apparatus. So it's a form of organization or of organizing social life and even thought processes that are counter to things like hierarchy, domination, and so on. But then they make this interesting claim. They say that the state apparatus doesn't have its own war machine. And so it appropriates the nomadic war machine. And so you start thinking, okay, great. So there's the nomadic war machine that is that resists the state apparatus. But at the same time, it's also something that the state apparatus kind of captures. So how does it work? So for them, it is, of course, it is something that resists. But I guess a good way of thinking about this in practical terms is recuperation. And we often see this, right? We often see radical protests and so on, and then we see the police come in and we see the state come in or some state officer, and they make a kind of deal with the protesting people. They co-opt them. And so we can think of it as a pharmacon. We can think of it, the nomadic war machine, as something that can be used to effectuate freedom in the world, or it is something that can be used against us again. And so it requires a little bit of vigilance, really, is this nomadic war machine. So a good way of thinking about it is then in terms of this kind of continuing revolution. And that's something that I think especially contemporary anarchists have thought about a lot. You know, revolution for them is definitely for the majority of anarchists living today. You know, and revolution is not something that is this kind of event that is going to take place and going to change the world, which is what they used to think, right? That was very much in the kind of early conception of revolution. No, rather revolution is seen as something almost that is accumulative. So it's something that we practice in the here and now, individually, together, all the time. It is a kind of persistent action towards freedom, or towards more freedom. And so I really like that idea of persistent action, you know, kind of compulsion almost, towards better ways of living. And what does that mean? It really means that the revolution is something that we construct and we co-construct. And it's also the thing that I would say, you know, Stiegler talks about how the kind of, how desire, we can say, a desire for life and for communal life has kind of been disrupted. And this has left many people feeling disaffected, like life is not worth living. And revolution for me is almost that thing. He talks about needing long circuits. What are long circuits? Well, long circuits for him is the stuff that allows for kind of, we can think of it as something like transgenerational memory. Now, if something has a long history, now this is what the state does well, right? Think about it. The state creates transgenerational memory, long circuits. And so that allows it to auto-reproduce itself in our thought and in the real world. Now, if we have practices in the real world that have been disrupted, like community, for example, communal practices have been disrupted so much because we're online all the time, it's very difficult to have memories of what protests used to look like or what people used to do when, you know, the police came in. You know, what are the tactics that you can use? So those kinds of things, that's a very practical way of thinking about it, right? Is those practical elements start forming the stuff of long circuits, the kind of memory we need to make us feel that life is worth living. And that really, for me, is the revolution. The revolution is not just this thing that changes the world. It's that which builds long-term memories of these kind of political and social practices that enable freedom. And so I guess it's a little bit of a different conception of revolution. But, you know, that's also what Deleuze and Guattari think about when they think about the nomadic war machine. You know, of course, the image one gets, well, at least I, you know, you get this image of a war machine. And lots of people have said, why did they have to use this idea of war machine? But I think it's because in war, something gets destroyed before something new can come out of it. Mm. And so there has to be that kind of, there is a destructive element that runs alongside this will to life. And so, you know, I think that's really important to remember in this kind of idea of revolution.
Well, your explication of the book and its contents have been absolutely fantastic. I was taken aback at every chapter on the ways you definitely were able to employ Deleuze and Guattari, as well as contemporary anarchist theories and thoughts and practices to illuminate issues as old as state existence and algorithmic governmentality. So thank you for answering these questions and elaborating on these very pertinent and relevant theories of these two philosophers. But before we end the podcast, I just want to ask if you have any future projects planned relating to either or Deleuze Guattari or anarchism.
Well, I guess the final chapters sort of is where my thought is going. So I'm very much in the land of cybernetics at the moment, thinking about cybernetics and anarchism. My thought on cybernetics has changed quite a lot. I don't only have negative thoughts about it because it's such a complex field. But I guess there's something interesting for me about the bridge between science, technology, and anarchism and Deleuze and Guattari, and the way that they, you know, maybe the way that we can rethink even the kind of the necessity for the sciences and the humanities. So I guess that's a broad way of answering you. But, you know, these are big debates going on, you know, constant debate, like, do we need the humanities? What does the humanities do? And this is something that is really interesting in Deleuze and Guattari's work, is that they draw very heavily on the sciences, the biological sciences, the arts, culture, so the humanities, you know, philosophy. And I think they bring together something so uniquely for thinking about kind of cosmological questions. And they do so philosophically, not scientifically. But I think there's a kind of a bridge that I'm looking for at the moment.
No, yeah. Deleuze and Guattari have received much scorn for their appropriation of scientific terms and terminology, but I nonetheless think the way they employ it is fruitful and interesting, and I think core to their most relevant theories. So I'm excited to see, Chantel, where that research goes in the future. Thank you for sharing. Well, Chantel, thank you again so much for this interview and for discussing this wonderful and provocative book, Anarchism After Deleuze and Guattari.
Thank you so much, Jackson. It was really lovely to be here. And thank you so much for your thoughtful questions. I really appreciate that.
Now, thank you for joining me today. I have been your host, Jackson Reinhart, discussing Anarchism After Deleuze and Guattari, Fabulating Futures, written by Chantel Gray, published by Bloomsbury, 2022. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great rest of your day.